Good afternoon. The time is 12:06 and you're tuned to Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. We'd love for you to join today's conversation, so give us a call at 260-452-1185. You can always post on our Facebook page or send us a note at middaymatters@nipr.fm. I'm Sarah D'Elia, and I'm joined by my Wednesday co-host, Dr. Barth Ragatz.
Hi, Sarah, and hi to our listeners. We have a guest with us here in the studio today, Sarah, Dr. Ron Bonfiglio. And Dr. Ron is coming back to the Midwest now after departure in Arizona. He's going to talk to us today about physical and rehabilitation medicine. And he grew up in Lima, Ohio, was a baseball catcher in the old days. He's a graduate of the Medical College of Ohio there in Toledo, and he's also board certified in physical medicine and rehabilitation medicine. Welcome, Dr. Ron.
Thank you.
Well, I thought we would start off just doing a little defining for our listeners as to you work at the rehabilitation hospital in town within the Lutheran Medical Group, and let's talk about what kind of patients you're seeing at the hospital and who qualifies to be admitted into the rehabilitation hospital.
A person who needs inpatient rehabilitation usually has had some type of medical illness, or they've had an orthopedic problem. Examples of patients that we normally evaluate would be someone that's had a stroke, a head injury, spinal cord injury. Orthopedic conditions would be a hip fracture if they've had a hip replacement, knee replacement, or if they've just had some generalized weakness due to a longstanding medical illness such as a pneumonia or a heart attack.
Okay. All right. And we talked a little bit before the show started. You're generally seeing patients who are 14 of age and up. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And so all shapes and sizes and of suffering from a variety of different physical ailments are the type that you're going to be seeing at the rehab center or the rehab hospital, excuse me.
That's correct.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about when folks think of rehab, a couple of different things come to mind. And one thing that's different that you all don't especially do, but I think it's important to talk about the difference, is you guys are not a skilled nursing facility. Talk a little bit about the difference between what that is, who goes there, and the rehabilitation hospital.
The criteria for an inpatient rehabilitation stay is for someone that's going to be able to tolerate 3 hours of inpatient rehab per day, and that's spread over 7 days.
Okay.
But they will require at least 15 hours of skilled therapy per week, and that can be a combination of physical therapy, occupational therapy, or speech therapy. To qualify for inpatient rehabilitation, they require two of those modalities, or they could have all three.
Okay. So let's say that I unfortunately have suffered from a heart attack and I'm in need of some rehabilitation. What are my first steps checking into the rehab hospital?
Prior to coming to the rehab hospital, your case has been reviewed by myself and by our screeners, and we have verified that you do qualify. Insurance has also qualified you. You will then be transported to the inpatient rehabilitation hospital. As soon as you come into the inpatient rehabilitation hospital, you'll be assigned a room. We have 36 beds in our rehabilitation hospital. 20 of them are private rooms. The other 16 beds are in 8 rooms with 2 beds each. You'll be greeted by one of the nurses. The nurses will do your initial intake and establish your history and things of that nature. And then the order process will then start at that point, and then a rehabilitation physician or neurologist will see that person within 24 hours of admission.
And is there an idea before you actually check into the hospital how long you're going to be staying, or is that something that you have to assess based on the progress that you're making?
I do make an initial assessment as I'm reviewing the paperwork and bringing the person over initially. I do have some time frames in mind just from prior experience, but each individual case is unique, and some people do require a little bit longer stay. Some require a little bit shorter stay. What we normally will do is, depending on when the person comes in, we will have a team conference either Tuesday or Thursday morning. And at that time, the whole team gets together, which consists of the nursing staff, the therapists, the case managers and myself, and we talk about the patient's presentation and progress, and that's when we set the initial target discharge date.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dr. Bonfiglio, I'm a little bit curious about the insurance hoops that one has to jump through, and I imagine the staff probably helps a little bit with that, don't they?
They very much do. Usually that's taken care of by the screening process.
Uh-huh.
Right from the very beginning, we know if a person has private insurance or if they have Medicare. And once we establish what payer source the person has, then we'll start working with that payer source and making sure that we get that certified prior to the patient arriving to the hospital.
Oh, all right. Now, you say that the staff work with these patients up to 3 hours per day, 7 days a week. And could you tell the listeners a little bit about the difference of the duties between physical therapists and occupational therapists?
Most definitely. Physical therapists usually are more involved with mobility, that being walking, transferring in and out of bed to wheelchair. They'll also look at strength. They'll work with all four limbs. They'll work with a person's core and trunk, and they will be working on that. Occupational therapy is more focused on doing activities of daily living. That could be cooking, cleaning, just all different things that a person would normally do in their everyday life. They'll also be dealing with how a person is able to dress themselves, feed themselves, mm-hmm. grooming, and then also their personal hygiene.
Oh, okay. Now, most of the patients then, when they're ready to leave the hospital, go home directly?
That's always our number one goal.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
We always want to try to reestablish and restore as much function as possible so that they can return back to their prior environment. We're hoping to restore function to the point where they were before they were ill and or maybe even a little bit stronger and, mm-hmm. and more active than what they were before their illness.
Very good.
260-452-1185 is the number to call. If you have a question or comment, you can always post on our Facebook page or send us a note at middaymatters@nipr.fm. We're joined by Dr. Ron Bonfiglio, who is of the Rehabilitation Hospital here in Fort Wayne. I'm Sarah D'Elia, and I'm joined by my Wednesday co-host, Dr. Barth Ragatz. And Dr. Ron, I wanted to back up just a second and talk a little bit about the collaboration that goes on within the Rehabilitation Hospital, because it seems like you mentioned that there are conferences about individual patients and coming up with goals. What are some of those, getting back to my example, if I'm somebody that went in for suffering from a heart attack, what would some of the basic goals be for me upon my later stay at the hospital? I'm sure there's, you know, you start off with basic things that you want to make sure that you're relearning, and then by the end, what are some of the more advanced goals, I suppose?
For someone that's had a heart attack, we would want to make sure that their walking ability is what it has been in the past, or again, maybe even a little bit better mm-hmm. than what it was before they were ill. We would want to make sure that they were doing things as pain-free as possible also,
mm-hmm.
Because obviously the heart is going to require recovery for several months, and we want to make sure that we're not putting too much of a burden onto the heart and also probably the lungs. So we're just wanting to make sure that the functional exercise correlates with the recovery period.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also then would transition that person into some outpatient therapy that they would either do in an outpatient clinic or in their home.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask, because it doesn't seem, I'm sure the work's not over once you leave the hospital.
Right, most definitely not. It's definitely oftentimes a real lifestyle change also.
Mm.
Just making sure that a person stays as active as possible, and then eating healthy and making sure that they follow up with their family physicians and cardiologist and whoever else has consulted on that patient in the recent past.
Mm-hmm.
Are there some recommendations there in general for continuing exercise there and rehabilitation? How much, how frequently, and so forth?
Most definitely. What I've seen is the therapist will give a home program to the patient that they are to follow until they transition into their outpatient setting. So most definitely the patient is educated, and oftentimes the family members are educated as to what the capabilities are of that particular person,
mm-hmm.
and they can then also help to monitor how the person's feeling.
Okay. So the family kind of becomes part of the long-term rehabilitation team, and then also we have some outpatient therapy probably ongoing for some of these patients.
That's correct.
Uh-huh.
260-452-1185 is the number to call if you have a question or a comment. We're talking to Dr. Ron Bonfiglio about the rehabilitation hospital in Fort Wayne. And I wanted to ask, we've talked a little bit about the physical therapy and we talked about the occupational therapy. Is there any kind of emotional therapy for folks who are going through this? Because I imagine sometimes life doesn't change all that much and you can go back to the way things were before an injury, but oftentimes you can't. What kind of support does the hospital provide for those individuals?
We do have a neuropsychologist who's in the hospital mm-hmm. at least 2 half-days a week. His name is Dr. Brinkman, mm-hmm. and he will evaluate those patients' needs and also will continue to treat those needs. Mm-hmm. The speech therapist will also deal in that realm, making sure that the speech and the cognition improves also. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of people there at the rehab hospital that are looking at that particular aspect and making sure that those deficits are identified and treated well.
Mm-hmm. So not just about body healing, but also the mind.
Most definitely.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure, depending on the injury, that kind of dictates how long a patient is going to stay at the rehabilitation hospital. But give us a range. What's typically the shortest amount and a longer stay at the hospital?
I would say the shortest amount usually is with our orthopedic cases. Mm-hmm. If someone's had knee replacement or hip replacement, those lengths of stays can sometimes be as short as 4 to 5 days. Mm-hmm. The longest stays are usually your traumatic brain injury or spinal cord injury patients, and those usually average right now around 30 days. They can sometimes go just a tad longer, but usually no more than about a month.
Okay. We're going to take a short break on Health 360 Midday Matters, but in the meantime, if you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 260-452-1185. You can always post on our Facebook page, or you can send us a note at middaymatters@nipr.fm.
It seems everyone has an opinion on the Chicago teachers' strike, but when it comes to teachers' unions, how much do we really know? I'm Neil Conan. Teachers' unions, myths and realities, plus one of the last knuckleballers in the major leagues and one of the best pitchers in baseball, the Mets' R.A. Dickey, joins us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Tune in weekdays at 2 here on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
You help pay for public education in Indiana, but from the Capitol to the classroom, the payback isn't always clear. You can find out how the state's policy impacts your family in our new State Impact Indiana Project, a local national collaboration between Indiana public broadcasting stations and NPR. You can hear the stories during Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Weekend Edition on NIPR, and dig deeper with a click on the State Impact logo at nipr.fm.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Doug Saunders says the video insulting the Prophet Muhammad that provoked violent protests last week was promoted by a movement that plays on fears that growing Islamic communities in Europe and the U.S. represent a threat to Western values and security. Saunders' new book is called The Myth of the Muslim Tide. Join us.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Cameron Memorial Community Hospital, providing health and wellness services in the spirit of charity, concern, and excellence, serving Steuben County and surrounding areas. Information at CameronMCH.com.
Welcome back to Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOI. The time is 12:21. If you have a question or comment, we'd love to hear from you. 260-452-1185 is the number to call. You can always send us a note at middaymatters@nipr.fm, or you can post on our Facebook page. I'm Sarah D'Elia, and I'm joined by my Wednesday co-host, Dr. Barth Ragatz. And in the studio today, we have Dr. Ron Bonfiglio, who is of the Rehabilitation Hospital here in Fort Wayne. And I want to ask you, Dr. Ron, What if we have a listener who thinks that they may either need the facilities of the rehabilitation hospital, or they have a loved one who's in a hospital that's going to be discharged and may need some rehabilitation care, how can they get a hold of you and start the process of being checked in?
If their loved one is still in a hospital, the best thing would be to speak with the treating physicians and make sure that a consultation is given to the rehabilitation hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of our professional screeners will take a look at that case and make sure and review that. If the person's at home,
mm-hmm.
we can have a screener go to the home and evaluate the patient in their home. So that's always a real benefit also. In our healthcare system, as we know it now, oftentimes people are discharged fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And if a person is discharged to home and finds that they're not doing well at home and thinks that they could benefit from an inpatient rehabilitation stay, then that is when they or one of their loved ones should contact the rehabilitation hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can set up an appointment to actually go out to the home and interview them.
And how do home evaluations actually work? Like, what would the physician be looking for at that individual's home to decide whether or not they need to be checked into the rehabilitation hospital?
I'd be looking to see what function they had prior to being ill,
mm-hmm.
and what functional deficits that they have currently.
Okay.
And if they currently have a significant amount of deficits that we feel we can improve upon, then that would be a criteria that I would look at,
mm-hmm.
to possibly admit that patient.
Mm-hmm.
Do you also give the patient some clues about, and the family, about maybe modifications that need to be made in their living environment when they return home?
We definitely do. And oftentimes, if they live close enough, we'll do a home evaluation. And a home evaluation will consist of one or more therapists going out with the patient and all the loved ones and looking at the home situation and coming up with any adaptations or accommodations that may help the person, such as a ramp or things that may be put in place in a patient's bathroom or possibly in the kitchen area, just mm-hmm. to make a safe discharge.
Mm-hmm. And are there any stories that you've experienced in your medical career that you would want to share with us about how you've seen the work of rehabilitation and rehabilitation hospitals really impact somebody's lives and change them?
Very much so. Been doing this for over 20 years now and really have seen a lot of people recover, function at just a miraculous pace. I think early on in my career, the most significant case I had was working with a gentleman that had actually been mugged in Chicago,
mm.
and came to our facility and was on a lot of different medications. And I was fortunate enough at the time to work with another rehabilitation physician who had been a pharmacist in his prior life. And he knew one of the medications that the patient had been on was maybe possibly keeping this patient in a coma. So we stopped the medication on a Friday, and by Monday morning, that patient was upright, talking, and participating in therapies and had fully come out of his coma.
Wow.
So that was probably the most significant recovery that I had seen in my career.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
It is. Uh-huh.
And what an amazing thing to be a part of. 260-452-1185 is the number to call, or you can always post on the Facebook page, our Facebook page, or send us a note at middaymatters@nipr.fm. We're talking to Dr. Ron Bonfiglio of the Rehabilitation Hospital in Fort Wayne. And we have just about 4 minutes left. What haven't we talked about that folks need to know about the facilities and the service that you all are providing at the Rehabilitation Hospital?
I think one thing that I'd like to reinforce is just the criteria difference between a skilled nursing facility, nursing home, versus inpatient rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm.
Skilled nursing facility also does wonderful quality work. I've worked in nursing homes myself. The only thing a nursing home will do differently than a rehab hospital is they will allow the patient to receive their therapies at a slower pace.
Mm-hmm.
They will look at the patient's abilities and deficits, and they will allow the therapies to be spread over a lengthier period of time.
Mm-hmm.
They also don't have to require the 3 hours of intense therapy per day.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the medical issues are not usually as acute or sophisticated in a nursing home as what they may be in a rehab hospital. at a rehab hospital, a physician such as myself or an internal medicine physician is usually seeing those patients either every day or every other day. Mm. Where in a skilled nursing facility, they'll be seeing them on the average of a week.
Okay.
Now, obviously, if a person needs more attention in a skilled nursing facility, I know they'll receive that. But on the average, a physician usually will see them once a week.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the difference between the two facilities.
Right. And before the show, you did a really great job of explaining it to me about how if you are checked into the rehabilitation hospital, you are going to be there for, if you're going to be there for 2 weeks, you're going to be there for 2 weeks. It's unless you have an extenuating circumstance like a funeral or something like that, you're going to be putting in the work to get back to where you need to be.
That's correct. Yes. When a person comes to the inpatient rehab hospital, we definitely need to show functional gains, whether that be to a private insurance or to Medicare. We would just want to make sure that we're showing progress on a daily to mm-hmm. weekly basis.
Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you, since you are new to Fort Wayne, what challenges are you looking forward to working with at the rehab hospital? What are you most looking forward to being in the area and being a part of the team at the rehabilitation hospital?
I think what I enjoy most is just building programs and working with the neurologists who were at the rehab hospital prior to me coming.
Mm-hmm.
So just developing relationships with them and then developing relationships with all of the area physicians, not just in the Lutheran Health Network, but in all the health networks around.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, we're glad that you're here and welcome to Fort Wayne. We've been talking to Dr. Ron Bonfiglio of the Rehabilitation Hospital here in Fort Wayne. If you have a question or comment, 260-452-1185. You can always post on our Facebook page or send us a note at middaymatters@nipr.fm. I'm Sarah D'Elia. My co-host, Dr. Barth Ragatz, and I are going to take a short break, and we'll be back with more Midday Matters here on WBOI in just a few moments.
It's not easy being a Democrat in the Deep South.
I don't talk about it. It's the elephant in the room, so to speak. Most of my friends are Republican, I think, but I just don't bring it up.
So how are Democrats planning to regain relevance in such red territory? We'll take a look at their strategies later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered airs weekday afternoons at 4 on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
Good afternoon. I'm Katie Anderson with WBOI News. A Fort Wayne utility official says a video from an Illinois lawmaker's office posted on YouTube about the city's Great Lakes pollution impact is patently false. The video posted by Republican U.S. Senator Mark Kirk's office accuses Fort Wayne of dumping 7.5 billion gallons of sewage into Lake Erie's tributaries each year and lists the city as a worse polluter than Chicago, Cleveland, and Detroit. A representative from Fort Wayne City Utilities told city council members who watched the video Tuesday that the segment is patently false and just absurd. He said it exaggerates Fort Wayne's annual sewage overflows by 6.5 billion gallons. He says Fort Wayne actually releases about 1 billion gallons of sewage and stormwater into Lake Erie's tributaries each year. State lawmakers are exploring ways to crack down on sales tax zappers, the 21st century's version of skimming from the cash register. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports, only 8 states have banned the programs.
Sales tax zappers are computer programs that allow stores to delete purchases or parts of purchases from their records. The store then doesn't report the transaction to the government and doesn't pay sales tax on it. Last session, a bill in the General Assembly that would make selling or owning a zapper a Class C felony failed to make it out of committee. But Bryce Berg says just banning zappers may not curb the practice. Berg is a consultant with CGI, a Canadian company with experience combating zappers. He says a more effective method is installing sales recording modules, small computers between the cash register and the receipt printer.
So anything that gets entered into the cash register would flow through this SRM, the sales recording module, and would be captured in there.
Those records would then be available to the government. Berg says based on the use of SRMs in Canada, Indiana could recover nearly $60 million a year in lost revenue. Cicero Republican Representative Eric Turner, who introduced last session's zapper bill, says SRMs could place a burden on restaurants where zappers are most commonly used.
Well, I'd certainly first be concerned about the cost to those local restaurants. We have a lot of mom and pops in this state.
Turner says he expects legislation to ban zappers next session, but isn't sure the General Assembly will want to go any farther than that. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
On Tuesday, Fort Wayne Mayor Tom Henry discussed plans for community leaders and neighborhood representatives to gather in Fort Wayne for the Regional Neighborhood Network Conference. WBOI's Sarah D'Elia reports.
The city estimates that about 300 people will travel to next week's conference. That includes participants from Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Kentucky, and Tennessee. One of the goals of the conference is to give community leaders new ideas on ways to improve and upkeep neighborhoods. During the conference, local neighborhood leaders will join in discussions on issues such as crime prevention, youth engagement, and neighborhood revitalization. Mayor Henry says the city of Fort Wayne, which has not hosted the conference since 2002, now has the economic resources to better host the event.
I think we're becoming famous for bringing a lot of conferences to Fort Wayne because of the quality of life of our community and the fact that we now have places and restaurants and hospitality downtown that unfortunately weren't here several years ago.
The RNNC conference takes place September 27th through September 29th. For WBOY News, I'm Sarah D'Elia.
The Fort Wayne Tin Caps have announced an extension of their current affiliation. WBOY's Doug Gruber has the details.
The Tin Caps announced that they have extended their player development contract with the San Diego Padres for another 2 years. Tin Caps President Mike Nutter, along with San Diego Padres Executive Vice President General Manager Josh Burns, made the announcement. The new agreement between the Tin Caps and the Padres will extend the relationship between the two clubs through the 2013 and 2014 seasons. This will mark the 15th and 16th consecutive years the two franchises have been affiliated. Of the nearly 200 teams in minor league baseball, only 8 are located farther from their parent club than Fort Wayne is from San Diego. But even at that distance, it's hard to argue with success. The Tin Caps set a franchise attendance record this past season, with 408,044 fans passing through the gates at Parkview Field. That was second only to Dayton in the 16-team league. For WBOI News, I'm Doug Gruber.
And now back to Midday Matters with your host, Sarah D'Elia.
Welcome back to Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY 89.1 FM. It's 12:34. I'm Sarah D'Elia, and I'm joined by my Wednesday co-host, Dr. Barth Ragatz.
Hi, Sarah. We've got a good friend of ours back in the studio, Dr. Mark O'Shaughnessy. And to remind the listeners, Dr. O'Shaughnessy is a board-certified cardiologist, and he's a graduate of IU School of Medicine, began his medical career here in at the Fort Wayne Center. And Dr. Mark, remind me, I think you did your residencies and all of your fellowship training within IU also. Is that correct?
Yes, all in Indianapolis.
Uh-huh. Well, very good. Well, we're delighted to have you back with us today, and we're going to be talking about congestive heart failure. Obviously an important issue. How many of your patients are troubled with congestive heart failure?
Well, I'm the medical director of our congestive heart failure unit, so a lot of my patients are. But
yeah.
Currently in the United States, there's about 5 million people with congestive heart failure, and there's 500,000 new diagnoses a year. So it's a huge medical problem.
What are some of the symptoms that the patient might experience that would lead to a referral to you or one of your partners?
The most common symptom is just tiredness and shortness of breath are the two typical symptoms that people have. Swelling in their legs is another symptom that gets them referred to me, but that's not necessarily a congestive heart failure problem. So mostly it's tiredness and shortness of breath are the two primary symptoms that people would have.
I see. Okay. And so they get referred to you, and I suppose there's probably a variety of causes that have given them this problem in the first place.
Yeah, the bottom line is congestive heart failure is a broken pump. Your heart's a pump, and the pump breaks, and so you don't get the effective squeezing of the heart, and so blood doesn't move forward. And I tell my patients that your heart's basically your generator, and in patients your generator's broken, and so you have less than its normal output. And if you have, say, your ejection fraction, which is a number that we can assess is half of what it should be, it's like going in your house and turning off half the circuits in the circuit board. You go into certain rooms, lights aren't going to come on. And so that's the fatigue part of it. And then if your blood's not being pumped forward, it'll back up. And so you'll get shortness of breath because of that. So the symptoms are the shortness of breath and tiredness. And the typical studies that we do, the most important study we do is an echocardiogram, is an ultrasound of one's heart. To look at your heart pumping function, look at the valves, look at everything about the heart. It's a totally non-invasive study that's painless and gives us a tremendous amount of information about the heart.
Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit more about this ejection fraction and what's a good one versus a not-so-good one?
So an ejection fraction is basically we measure a number and we see how much your heart squeezes with each beat. And so a normal ejection fraction is 60%. Every time your heart squeezes, it doesn't empty every drop of blood out of your heart, kind of good to the last drop kind of a thing. It empties about 60% of the blood out of your heart each time it squeezes. That's a normal ejection fraction. Ejection fractions that are less than that can vary anywhere from, I've seen ejection fractions of less than 10%, very severe heart muscle injury, to only mildly decreased, about 50%. And so when we say a person has an ejection fraction of 50%, it doesn't mean they have only 50% of their heart function. It means that their normal ejection fraction is 60%. So if they had an ejection fraction of 30%, then they have half, 50% of heart function. So therein lies the confusing factors. The causes that you ask about, the most common cause in this country, of course, is blocked arteries. Prior heart attacks. There are many other causes of congestive heart failure. Certain chemotherapy drugs can cause heart muscle injury. Certain toxins, alcohol in excess, can cause heart muscle injury. Valve problems, inborn heart problems, and then there's a whole group of things that are caused idiopathic. I've ruled out everything else, and I basically have heart muscle injury, and we don't really know why that injury is. Most commonly, that's a virus. A virus injures the heart.
I see. And the patient probably isn't aware of any particular viral infection, but somewhere in the aftermath, their heart function begins to diminish.
Typically, what ends up happening, I will see a patient who has been treated by their family doctor appropriately. They come in with a cold or a bronchitis, and they've gotten a course of antibiotics, and they didn't get any better. Their cough persisted. They're tired, and they're still coughing and short of breath. They get another course of antibiotics. And over a period of about 2 or 3 months, they've had this repeated antibiotics and just not getting any better. That's when I see the patient. We do the ultrasound, and their heart muscle is severely injured. So that's a fairly classic presentation of a viral cardiomyopathy. They had an insulting agent 2 or 3 months prior, and then they come and finally see me.
Do we know much about the genetics? You know, for example, if you had a parent that suffered from CHF, do you have a certain risk? And then if you had two parents that suffered from the disorder?
There is a familial cardiomyopathy. It's rare. It's very rare, but there is a familial form that it does run in families. The inheritance actually comes from the coronary artery disease standpoint, the atherosclerosis, the fat and cholesterol buildup. There's no question that that's an inherited abnormality. It's one of the risk factors of positive family history for coronary artery disease. It being far and away the most common cause of congestive heart failure, that's where the inheritance comes in. If you have families that have a tendency to have heart attacks, you're at a higher risk for having a heart attack, and so you could theoretically have it. But it does, heart failure doesn't typically run in families, but it's such a common problem that if you talk to family members, several of them are going to have it, and it's not unless they're one of the rare inherited forms. Most commonly, it's due to something else.
What are those steps you should be taking if you know that your father or mother passed away or suffered from a heart attack, and you're much younger, but you know, and don't have any signs, and you're in good health? It may not seem like you need to be concerned about that, but that's not necessarily the case. What are the signs that you can take as a young person to make sure that you're not going to be following in those footsteps?
Well, we know the typical risk factors for coronary artery disease, family history, male gender, men have higher incidence of heart diseases compared to women, cigarette smoking, diabetes, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol. Those are the five main risk factors. And so if you have a family history, you have one strike against you. So you want to make sure you do everything else right. And I tell patients and I tell people when I talk to them, you need to know your numbers. And when I say that, I mean you need to know what your blood pressure is, what your cholesterol is, and what your sugar is. And absolutely, again, I'm an unapologetic supporter of a total smoking ban. Cigarette smoking is the number one cause of heart disease in America unquestioned. And so if people want to smoke, that's okay. You're going to keep me in a job. But bottom line is you're going to have a complication of that cigarette smoking. So the things that somebody can do if they're young and they have a family history mm-hmm. are know your numbers, make sure that you, and you say, well, my family doctor knows my numbers. I feel it very important. You can't be a part of your disease or take care of yourself if you don't know what your numbers are. So right. you should know what your sugar is, know what your blood pressure is, and know what your cholesterol is. And mm-hmm. if they're elevated, then you treat those. Mm. And then really, it's very simple. It's moderation. Diet, moderation in your diet, moderate daily exercise will go and then no smoking will go a long way to preventing you from developing this disease process. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What level of exercise do we recommend now for, say, the older listeners?
It's the same as for the younger listeners. The current Surgeon General is actually recommending 40 to 60 minutes most days of the week.
Uh-huh.
And so and you say, well, I can't walk 60 minutes, and I don't expect you to do that. I will use my mother as an example. My mother has not been an exerciser, bless her heart, all of her life. She had some health issues. She kept saying, Mark, I'm so short of breath. I'm so short of breath. I said, Mom, you never exercise. Mm-hmm. And so when we first started an exercise program with my mother, she could not make it to her mailbox, which is about probably 200 feet from her house, without mm-hmm. being extremely short of breath. She's now walking a mile a day. She now has 29 miles logged for. She's going to do the senior marathon in 2 weeks at the Fort for Fitness.
Wow.
And so she's walking a mile a day, and she will still bitterly complain that she's short of breath uh-huh. as I'm walking the mile with her, and she's talking to me the entire way. So starting slow, she could walk to the mailbox and back, and uh-huh. working your way up, you can actually get 40 to 60 minutes of exercise
yes.
at any age.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. Tell us a little more about that senior marathon here. You've tweaked my interest.
It's the senior marathon is a wonderful program. It's the Fort for Fitness is the annual fall half marathon that was started mm-hmm. 5 years ago now. When Brad Kimmel, who is one of the race directors, came to us and said he would like our help with the half marathon, I said, we'll be happy to help out. You'll probably get 400 or 500 people at the race. Their first year, the half marathon had 3,500 participants.
Wow.
Second year, 5,000. Third year, 7,500. And the last 2 years will be 10,000 participants in mm-hmm. the various activities this fall. And it's actually the end of the month. It's the 28th of September. Well, they had a kids marathon where they're trying to get young kids active. And it was a really neat program. The kids logged their miles. It was on an honor system, and they logged 25 miles up until the end of the month throughout the whole summer. Mm-hmm. And then the last mile, 1.2 miles, which is a 26.2 is a full marathon. The last 1.2 miles they do at Parkview Field mm-hmm. downtown on Friday night.
Oh.
So several years ago, some grandparents said, I want to do something like that. And so the senior marathon was born. And so seniors can sign up. Now it's too late to sign up now because you have to really uh-huh. log your miles over the summer. But next summer, I definitely encourage people to do. And I really encourage people, if you want to see a really motivational evening, come down Friday evening, September 27th, to Parkview Field, free admission. And you'll see the kids finish their 26.2-mile endeavor and the seniors doing it as well. And it is an incredibly motivational type of a thing. These people, some of them have not exercised at all, a la my mother, and it's really, really cool to see them finish, reach a goal that they did. So mm-hmm. if you can't participate, just come out and watch, and I can tell you you'll want to participate next year.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fantastic, Dr. Mark, and we really congratulate you and your colleagues about all the things that you've done here with Fort for Fitness. Let's just repeat that time and place again. That's September 27th.
Friday evening,
uh-huh.
6 p.m. at Parkview Field.
Okay. Yeah. No admission fee?
No admission uh-huh. fee. They will go out and walk a mile, and they'll finish on the field with themselves on the Jumbotron. Mm-hmm. It's a really, that's what my mother's mm-hmm. looking forward to.
Yeah.
She's looking to her seeing herself on the Jumbotron, and everybody gets a medal, a finisher's medal, and she's looking for that hardware as
yeah.
well.
Very cool.
Well, that is very cool. That's great. Now, we talked a little bit about the symptoms and causes there, Dr. Mark. When the patient is first seen by you, what are some of the signs that you might also recognize here in the patient history and physical?
Well, we certainly ask them about, you know, their activity levels and what they can and can't do, their shortness of breath that they have with exercise, a couple of other symptoms that they will experience are shortness of breath when they lay down at night. We ask them, how many pillows do you sleep on?
Mm-hmm.
Because as they get more short of breath, they will add more pillows to prop themselves up. Mm-hmm. Because when you're sitting up, gravity pulls blood to the lower half of your body and away from your lungs. But when you lay down, it gets redistributed back up into your chest, and mm-hmm. it just kind of overloads the lungs and they get short of breath. Many times I say, I'm not even sleeping in bed, I'm sleeping in a recliner because when I lay down, I get short of breath.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then we listen, we do, of course, do a physical exam, and they will have certain signs that we can hear with our stethoscope that they're having problems with too much fluid in their system.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh. Those are lung sounds that you pick up?
Lung sounds and heart sounds, uh-huh. heart murmurs, gallop sounds, and lung sounds that we can hear fluid in their lungs.
Okay. Very good. I guess there's probably some lab work and other studies that you do to prove this diagnosis?
Yeah, the diagnostic procedure of choice, again, is the ultrasound. The ultrasound, it basically allows us to look. It's just like doing ultrasound for babies or anything else that we do in medicine, and it has gives us unbelievable pictures of the heart, and we can look at that ejection fraction, which we talked about, how the heart squeezes.
Mm-hmm.
We can get an idea as to the cause, because if it's due to blocked arteries, it's typically your heart is a three-dimensional structure, so one portion of your heart won't be working where the other portions are. That kind of gives us an idea that there might be blocked arteries. We can't see the arteries with ultrasound, but we can certainly get an idea that that might be causing it. We can see valve problems. Certain valve problems can contribute to that. We can see certain rhythm problems on the echocardiogram, the ultrasound, that'll help us trigger it. And then we can actually measure and watch blood flow in the heart. It's actually fascinating. It's using the color flow Doppler, just like they do the Doppler weather radar. We're doing mm-hmm. the same thing inside the heart, bouncing sound waves off of the red blood cells rather than water droplets and clouds.
Uh-huh.
And look at flow inside the heart. So you can get some really good information with an echocardiogram.
Oh, that's great. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I've heard and read quite a bit about role of inflammation, chronic inflammation here and some of the heart diseases. And the reason I brought that up, I know there's an out-of-town vendor that comes to Fort Wayne from time to time, and they measure things like C-reactive protein and the levels in the blood and so forth. And a lot of times you get back a lab report, but you're not real clear what to do with it. Are these kind of screens pretty useful? Are you better off seeing your primary care doctor as a first step there?
I think you're best seeing the primary care doctor, quite honestly, because they can put it into context. So the question regarding inflammation, Sarah had asked a question earlier, what can you do? When we talk mm-hmm. about those five risk factors mm-hmm. that are the classic risk factors, the bottom line is we don't have a clue why some people lay down cholesterol in their arteries and other people mm-hmm. don't. We think inflammation plays a role, but we don't even understand where inflammation plays a role.
Yeah.
CRP is called C-reactive protein, and so it's a nonspecific marker of inflammation. If you check a hsCRP, you check this level, it has been shown that it's an independent risk factor for having a cardiovascular event, heart attack, uh-huh. and stroke. The problem is we don't know why, we don't know how, and mm-hmm. I can't modify it. And so the problem that I have when you get these tests in a vacuum, not really understanding it, you go, oh, my level's high. I might be having a heart attack or stroke.
Yeah.
And I would say to you, and I can't do anything about it. And
uh-huh.
so I don't routinely check hsCRP because we don't really understand its role, the inflammation's role. It probably has a role, not quite sure where or why. And so we're in our infancy understanding it. As I was talking earlier, I had a medical student, and I was explaining to her that we're really waiting on the smarter generation, her generation, to mm-hmm. figure this stuff out for us.
Uh-huh.
We treated it in a kind of an old mechanical way with our angioplasty balloons and things like that, but we really want to figure it out, what's causing it, and prevent it in the first place, mm-hmm. other than the lifestyle modification we talked about. That's the holy grail. So inflammation may play a role. Exactly how or why, we don't really understand it.
And I remember from the last time that you came and visited with us, we talked a little bit about stress and that's impact on the heart and heart attacks in general. But it doesn't sound like that's one of the top five contributing factors to congestive heart failure or even to heart attacks. Is that true?
Well, it's an excellent point. It's gone back and forth. It's been a major risk factor. It's been a minor risk factor. And I think the problem is it's difficult to measure stress.
Right.
I can measure blood pressure. I can measure sugar. I can measure your cholesterol. I know whether you're a smoker or not. But what's stressful for you is not necessarily stressful for me. And so it's a very difficult thing to put your finger on. Is stress a major risk factor? And the answer is, quite honestly, we don't know. It has to play somewhat of a role, but exactly where it plays a role is interesting. There is a thing called broken heart syndrome. And broken heart syndrome, it's called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. And patients will come in the hospital after a severe emotional stress, loss of a spouse, death of a child, some other type, your house burned down, kind of a thing. And they come in with a chest pain syndrome, mm-hmm. like they're having a heart attack. We do a heart catheterization, and the entire front of their heart doesn't move at all. It's ballooned out, and their arteries are normal. They don't have any blockages. They didn't have a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, you give time, the heart muscle gets better. We call it broken heart syndrome because it gets better. It's called Takotsubo because it actually, the heart is shaped like a Japanese fishing vase that they use for octopus.
Oh, wow.
Octopus can get in, has a narrow neck, can't get back out. Uh-huh. So it actually looks like this kind of vase that you can capture octopus in. And so stress clearly plays a role in Takotsubo. How it plays a role in coronary artery disease is a much more difficult thing to parse out because, again, just really defining what is stressful for one person, what kind of degree of stress can you put on any given thing is difficult.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I suppose there's varying degrees of congestive heart failure among the patients.
Absolutely. So we basically use the New York Heart Association classification, and they have functional class 1 to 4. Functional class 1 being mild heart failure, functional class 4 being very severe heart failure, and it based on your symptom complexes. And so the worse your functional classification, the worse your heart failure is. But the thing is, you can move up and down on that functional classification as we adjust your medications and we do some modifications in lifestyle and those type of things to get you back into a more compensated state.
Uh-huh.
Sorry, go on, Barth.
I was going to ask Dr. O'Shaughnessy a little bit about how we manage these patients long-term with medications and so forth.
So the typical medications, if the water, you can't get rid of the water. If it's not moving forward, it backs up. So one of the ways we get rid of the water is we give water pills, diuretic medications, Lasix or furosemide or Demodex torsemide, spironolactone. There's a bunch of different water medications to get rid of the extra water. There's a standard therapy that's been around since the late 80s called the ACE inhibitors. That's the lisinoprils, the Vasotex, the Prenavils, Captoprils, anything that ends with a prill is a blood pressure medication, but it actually has some pretty good effects at improving the heart function. I was giving a little mini lecture to a medical student with me today, and one of the other standard therapies is called beta blockers. The metoprolols or Lopressors, Toprols or Coregs or Carvedilols. And I was explaining to her that it was dogma when I was in medical school about 25 years ago, you would never give a beta blocker to a patient with congestive heart failure.
It's
not indicated. It would make them worse. And lo and behold, it's a standard therapy now 25 years later. So I said, just wait around. Anything that's dogma during your training will be standard of care in about 25 or 30 years, as we understand that. And then the other thing that's changed is pacemaking. Patients used to ask me when I was early in my career, what about a pacemaker for my heart failure? And I would say, a pacemaker is for electrical problem, and this is a pumping problem. And turns out that was wrong as well. And we have some very fancy devices that can actually resynchronize the heart's pacing and actually improve the heart function. And so they're called resynchronization therapy or biventricular pacemaker ICDs, very fancy devices that can improve their heart pumping function. Of course, ultimately, the last treatment option would be transplant. And, transplant fixes the pumping problem, but you trade one set of problems for a whole new set of problems. Because now I have somebody else's organ in that person. I have to fool the immune system for the rest of that patient's life to not reject that organ. And so we certainly try not to do transplant because of the intended problems that occur. But occasionally, in those patients who don't react to everything else that we do, we have to go to transplant.
Yes. What percent would you say? I guess pretty small percent.
Very small percent. Now, given the fact that our therapies, our medical therapies, our defibrillator therapies, those pacemakers have gotten so much better. It's less than 1% of patients end up going on to that. Mm-hmm. they're looking at the partial artificial hearts, the, you know, the old Jarvik hearts, the old implantable hearts. Mm. The heart that God gave us is unbelievably intricate and sophisticated. And although our technology is pretty amazing, doesn't come close.
Yeah.
And so those devices, although they are bridges, they simply aren't ready for implanting in everybody. So if we can treat you with medications, which we can, the vast majority of people, that's the best approach.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
We have just about 3 minutes left in today's program, and I want to make sure that folks who have been listening, we've been talking to Dr. Mark O'Shaughnessy about congestive heart failure. If we can just go through the symptoms, the signs, and prevention one more time for folks that may be listening and thinking, oh, I have a loved one that's been complaining about shortness of breath. So just real quick, some of the symptoms that folks may be experiencing.
And they're fairly nonspecific symptoms, but tiredness, if you can't do the same amount of activity you did before, shortness of breath with activity or at rest, chest pain, of course, any chest pain, you need to talk to your family doctor. You seek emergency attention that chest pain is not going away. But really any recurring symptom from the waist up needs to be addressed and addressed initially with your family physician. You don't need a cardiologist initially, and then they can refer you on. And so those are the typical signs. Sometimes people will have swelling, they'll have weight gain and those kind of things. And so any sign or symptom that a person has, they really need to consider talking to their family doctor and say, I'm really concerned about this, and they can assess whether they need to do anything about it or not.
Mm-hmm. And if somebody's been having some of these symptoms or is just concerned in general and they want to start, you know, exercise will probably be something that their doctor recommends if they're not already doing it. Is that something that they should embark on their own, or is that something they need to consult with a physician with beforehand?
I think if you're over the age of 40, you really probably should talk to your primary care physician, make sure that you are healthy enough to do exercise. I can tell you that I take care of very sick hearts, and almost every single one of my patients can exercise, but they need to be make sure that they're still safe. And those things to do to prevent ever seeing a cardiologist is our simple dietary modification and exercise, moderate exercise every day. And again, most importantly, knowing your numbers, because you have to be part of your health. You can't rely on other people. It's really your responsibility.
Absolutely. And we have just about a minute left of the show. Any departing words you want to leave with our listening audience about the topic of congestive heart failure?
Yeah, in the past, congestive heart failure was kind of considered a death knell. You know, if I have congestive heart failure, I'm going to die. And that's not true. You can live a very long, productive, happy life with our current therapies for heart failure. And so it's very important to say that, to not become overly depressed. Say, I have heart failure, I'm going to die. You're not. We have people who can live for decades and be very productive. So it's with appropriate therapies, you can have a very long, happy life.
Mm-hmm. Great. And finally, why don't you give the date and the time of the Fort for Fitness event that you were speaking on earlier?
So again, it'd be Friday, September 27th. I feel bad I'm doing a commercial for this, but September 27th.
It's public radio. It's not a commercial.
At Parkview Field, and it's at 6 p.m., and that's the senior and it's kids marathon. Mm-hmm. It's a really, really, really cool event. The following day are the Fort for Fitness events, which are the half marathon, a 10K, and a 4 mile, and that's just as motivational. You will see people who... 40% of the participants in the Fort for Fitness events have never done any kind of event at all.
Wow.
So these people, some of these people come in and this is their first event, and you watch them finish, and I do a lot of races. Mm-hmm. It's the most motivational thing I think I've seen in a long time.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, Dr. Mark O'Shaughnessy, thank you so much for being a part of Health 360 today.
Thank you.
This is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 HD Channel 1, and we're streaming online at our new website, nipr.fm. This is WBOI Fort Wayne. Thanks so much to all of our listeners and all of our guests today. You can hear this edition of Health 360 at our website, nipr.fm. If you click in the podcast section of the website, it will be there, available by the end of the day. Barth and I will be back same time, same place next week at noon on Wednesday for more Health 360. We're coming up on 1 o'clock, and Fresh Air is up next.